going to be starting a new series, which is really just going to be called a topical series, so that gives us the opportunity to look at different topics that are too small to do a whole series on, but helps us touch on things that need addressing and would be helpful to be understood in a deeper way. And so the first thing I want to touch on tonight is church membership. Now, who can quote a verse that says you have to become a member of a church? Who knows that verse? Have you ever spoken to someone who said that they won't become a church member because there's no such verse? No verse tells me I have to be a church member. I've read some books that teach on the church which merely presume there's membership. Okay, they go into this and they'll be teaching about, okay, the members do this and this is how it works and stuff. But they never explain how one actually becomes a member. Or even goes into why you should be a member. Many churches in our day do not really distinguish between someone who regularly attends and members. And there's no requirements to becoming a member. There's no stipulated requirements. Well, what do I need to become a member? Well, nothing really. Just, you know, attend for 3 months, and if you decide you'd like the church, then you become a member, and that's it. It's settled. The deal is done. And thus there's confusion and misunderstanding about church membership. So there's no verse that says that you must become a church member, yet the Bible inescapably teaches that you must be a member. God's will isn't always revealed in the way we demand it should be. And many people ignore aspects of God's revelation because they aren't revealed in the way that other things are revealed. And so the things that are revealed in a certain way, you say, okay, I believe that, look, it says it there. And then you get to other things and you say, well, no, this isn't revealed in that way, therefore I ignore it or I don't believe it exists and I reject it as a biblical truth. And you can apply that to any degree. You know, you can get into the triune nature of the Godhead and use that same kind of argument because there's no particular verse that spells it out in the kind of Athanasian formula that we would like. So even though a person might not say this actually, that, you know, there's no verse for it, therefore I can do it, they actually act in that kind of a way. And their thinking is kind of, if God wanted such and such, then he would have said it like this. But seeing as that I don't see it anywhere that he says it like this, that means he hasn't said anything about that. And so they can ignore it. And church membership would probably fall into that category in some people's minds. Yet we'll see that the church membership is as inescapable as are the requirements for being a member. And the epistles, which for the most part were written to churches, they were full of teaching. There was instruction. There was exhortation. There was warnings. And these were given for the purpose of protecting those churches and bringing them into a state of maturity. So protecting them and maturing them. So this teaching was given. And the congregations needed protection from enemies who wanted to destroy them. And these enemies can take on many different forms and launch many different kinds of assaults against God's people. The attacks that can come in very numerous ways. The last time Paul saw the Ephesian church elders, he said to them in Acts 20, verses 29 and 30, "For I know this, that after my departure, savage wolves will come in among you, not sparing the flock. Also from among yourselves, men will rise up, speaking perverse things, to draw away the disciples after themselves." So time and again, the charge is given to the elders of the church to be watchful in protecting the flock. Protecting them from what? Okay, lies and deception. Protecting them from getting ideas that are contrary to God's truth. Protecting them from adopting ways of acting that are contrary to God's truth. And so these things need to be exposed and removed from the midst of the congregation. So protection is central to the idea of church membership. Protection of the individual believer and protection of the body as a whole. That's what's fundamental to the idea of membership. To destroy the body of believers, to destroy the local church, greatly undermines the individual believer. People think they can be an island, they can be this little light on their own. And you compromise the body and the individual is weakened as well, if not ultimately destroyed. Thus, the evil one uses external and internal enemies in order to undermine the integrity of the church and ultimately render it meaningless. Because once you've destroyed the truth, once you've failed to be conformed to Christ's mindset, you've basically rendered the church irrelevant. And we've got, well, there's a church on every corner in this nation, just about. The church, for the most part, has become irrelevant because the truth that it holds and upholds has been undermined and compromised. And the way the enemy undermines the church in this way. He gets people to think, say, and do things that contradict God's truth. So even a casual reading of Scripture will leave you with no doubt about the constant threat that there is to destroy the church by getting them to compromise the truth in some way. And so to compromise it in the way they think or compromise it in the way they act. So the local church as an institution needs to be protected from being compromised by error. And how does error try and work its way into an institution? How does it come in? It comes in by people spreading the error in some manner. However they're going to do that, it's multiple ways, but people are going to be spreading the error. And the local church needs to remain faithful to the whole of God's revealed truth. And this responsibility is inescapable. But this has to be done even while the individual members of the body have a say in shaping the character of that church. So the church has to protect this, and it's people bringing in bad ideas that undermine that body, and yet fundamental to the preservation and the support of that body are individuals directing that body. So you see, you've got this potential compromise, this potential problems all over the place. So vital to the individual being protected is the body remaining faithful, and one of the key components to the body remaining faithful is the individual having influence upon the character and the direction of the body. Now this is the same with any kind of governmental structure that you're going to set up. The same things are there. That's why you have guys coming, well, let's have a king. Well, because we can't trust the people. You know, why can't we trust the people? Well, because they have sin in their hearts. Okay, so we've got the king with the same sin in his heart, and we're going to make him over everybody. You know, how do we bring in checks and balances that are truly checks and balances? So basically what we have is the body chooses leaders to rule them in terms of an agreed upon set of truths. For the church, this is ultimately the Bible, but succinct summaries of the fundamental doctrines and practices of that congregation are very helpful in keeping the focus in the right place. Why do we have a succinct statement of faith? Because this is a big book. And it's very hard to keep your finger on all the buttons at the same time. So, you know, what are the fundamentals? What are the main things we need to be concerned about and that constantly get attacked? Those we lay out in our statement of faith, and those are the things that once they've been derived from Scripture, we formulate a statement of faith and say, this now is a succinct body of doctrine that can keep us on track. Obviously, the Bible remains your ultimate and supreme authority, but you've got a true reflection of that teaching of the Bible in your statement of faith. And so that is something that's helpful in serving as a quick reference point to see if things are staying on track and not being deviated. So vital to the individual being protected is the body remaining faithful. And as I said, one of the key components of the body remaining faithful is the individual having influence upon the character and direction of the body. They have a say in appointing a leader, and they serve as a check should the leaders go astray. So how do you protect the integrity of the body when the individuals have such a big part to play in determining its direction? And really what you need there is membership. Membership that requires people to understand and embrace the particular distinctives that the local body has subscribed to. And when people are on board with these truths and distinctives, then they covenant themselves to the body to remain faithful to these things and protect these things. So we covenant to do that. This is biblical truth. This is what we're doing. This is what the objective is. If you don't have membership, or if membership is merely a symbolic act that one can share after attending the church for 3 to 6 months, once you've attended for that long, you're just one of us, then there's no way to protect that church. There's no way to protect that distinctive body of truth and doctrine. There's no way to protect those things that you hold dear. So a body of people from a local congregation, for example, can adopt, say, a Reformed confession of faith, believing it to be the most faithful expression of Scripture. Okay, this is what we believe is the most faithful expression. So this is what we adopt. We support it, back it up with Scripture. So it's a small congregation. Maybe you've got 20 voting members, and you're growing slowly, but you're getting somewhere. Now, up the street from you, there's an Armenian church, mega church, and they have a blow-up, and half the church leaves. But a good proportion of them say, no, we want to stay in the area, and there's no other church close by. We're going to go and join that little church over there. So they come and start attending the little Reformed church. And there's no kind of strict understanding of membership. It's just kind of, hey, we just love the Lord, and you know, Jesus is our King, and we're going to follow Him. And after 6 months, the pastor of this little congregation gets a calling from another church, and so he leaves. And so you start your pastoral hunt. And so now we've got big membership. These guys have been here 6 months. They're part of us. We're one body. And now we're looking for a pastor. So now we've got 20 guys who are persuaded in the Reformed faith. They've got 20 votes, and we've got 200 votes in the Arminian faith. And we're going to vote on this pastor and appointing him to his position of authority. So the ability to protect that congregation in the way it was set up and where it was going now, has it's gone. The direction has changed. And thus, what's going to be the doctrinal emphasis of the new pastor is clearly going to be what the 200 want, and they're going to formulate their new congregation. Now, this is pure democracy. This is democracy at its most beautiful. It doesn't work if you're trying to preserve certain things. But it's a coup. You've lost that church. Church membership that requires an understanding of and commitment to specific doctrinal distinctives is the only way to protect both the sincere individual believer as well as the whole body. And key to the success of this ongoing protection rests upon the vigilance of each member. They each have to be vigilant. They each have to be responsible for the position and the authority that they've been given in their specific calling. There is a protection for the broader body as well when you have membership. When solid membership is practiced, it does protect the broader body. Because if a member leaves a church in an inappropriate way, whether he's under discipline or the manner in which he leaves a congregation where he was a member, and he goes to another church, and that person says, well, where were you a member? You know, if they say, well, I wasn't a member anyway, I was just kind of attended there for a while. He says, oh, no, I was a member of that church. Then that church is going to say, well, I'd like to contact the previous church or get some documentation and find out, okay, what were the circumstances of this separation? Because if this person is a troublemaker, then there's some control, because the churches will be in communication, and so you don't spread this virus from this person going around and infecting each congregation that he goes to. There is a protection in that aspect. This unsuspecting congregation has at least a warning shot. Now, in our church, we make a distinction between those who are members of the church and those who are voting members. And voting members are made up of heads of households who have a God-given responsibility to protect and lead. They are to protect themselves, they are to protect their families, and they are to protect the congregation that God has made them part of. That is their responsibility as a voting member, their jurisdiction. When a church falls apart, many people have neglected their responsibilities. You see, a collapse doesn't just happen in an instant. There's a long road that has gone down, that whole congregation has moved down, where lots of indicators were ignored. A faithful voting head of household is an extremely important component in ensuring the health of the body, and thus the whole body needs to be diligent in making sure that any new voters truly do embrace the established distinctives of the congregation. And so that's why we have our process where when a new member is announced to the congregation, the elders have already met with that person. They've already discerned his doctrinal stance, his commitment to the fundamental key doctrines of the congregation. And they've ascertained that, and then they will submit it to the other voting members whose job it is to also serve as protectors of themselves, their families, and the body, for their evaluation and their scrutiny. Do we go forward on this or do we not go forward on this? So when new heads of households are added to the church, then the same process goes through. So anytime there's a new head of household. But how are heads of households added to a church? Okay, you have the obvious one where a new family or a new individual comes and starts fellowshipping with you and decides that they would like to join your church. And so they become their head of household and they become a voting head of household member. But you've also got young men growing up in their homes. They're already members of the church and they're growing up. And they're getting older. Where's the transition point? How does that change? What does that look like as you're coming to that place? Well, you have to discern, well, what is a head of a household? How do you define that? Because a head of a household, that's God's objective for each young man, is to become a head of your household. That's his goal. That's where he's leading you, that you assume those responsibilities that young men and older men assume, and you carry those responsibilities and you apply them in all areas of life, but also in this particular area of your own home and your church. So when does a young man become his own head of his household? Our understanding is he becomes his own head of his household when he has the means and the will to support himself, to be his own head of household. He has the means And the other means, I mean, he has the financial ability to fully support himself. He's not financially dependent upon anybody, and he's acting from a financial perspective. He's able to do that fully. Now, how he chooses to pick his accommodation, etc., where he's going to live, that's a choice up to him. He can use his wisdom in different ways how that's done. But so it's financial independence and having the desire to become his own head of household. So referring to his fully supported financially. So when a young man has the means to support himself fully and acts to be as his own head of the household, then the church recognizes the existence of an independent head of household. It recognizes that and it relates to that individual in that way as the head of household, saying, okay, you have a relationship with us in that sense. There's a new entity that is in existence here, and then it will seek to establish whether this person qualifies as a voting member. And if the leadership believes that they do, then they will be presented to the congregation so that other voting members can serve in their protective role and evaluate whether there's agreement amongst the congregation, whether this is indeed correct evaluation. And should they find something or be suspicious of something that they think disqualifies this person, then they would approach the leaders and say, well, this is what's come to our attention, or this is what I'm aware of that you might not be aware of, and that will be evaluated. But the whole thing is protection. Protection of the individual and protection of the body. I'm going to stop there because I'm sure there might be questions and need for clarification. And so I'll open it up to discussion at that point.
I thought of a question. Would there ever be a case where you have a head of house that is, you know, using your definition, financially able to support himself, who becomes a member but is not a voting member? Would there ever be a case like that?
I just have to make sure I understand what you're saying. That the will and the means are both demonstrated.
Yes, but for some reason or another, he's not a voting member. Either, I don't know if it would be by his will or by the will of the elders or something. I'm just saying, does head of house always go together with voting? I mean, are those always the same thing, or is there ever a case where one is true and the other not?
Voting has to go through member first.
Oh, yeah. So then he's a member.
To survive that hurdle, which right. necessarily involved involvement and oversight. And
right, so he's the head of house, he wants to become a member, he becomes a member, but would there be something that would prevent him from voting? Like, I'm just trying to see if there is this category.
I can't see where there would be something like that, unless you were talking about somebody who is mentally incapacitated, but then I'm not sure. Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
When you state that he's a head of household, that means he's no longer under the protection of his father? I guess I'm always thought that as head of household, male, the way I interpret what Scripture calls it, is when he leaves his father and mother and cleaves to his wife. Now he becomes his head of household. But the way you explain it and everything, you're saying a young man who grows up is now become a man who's capable of taking care of himself financially. But I guess me as a father would struggle for him to say, okay, I'm going to go and buy my house and be my own. Is he still considered under the protection of the father?
No,
the father then would have to give him his blessing to say, okay, son, this is what you're planning on doing, this and this and that. I bless you with it. Go for it.
Ideally, that's the way you want to do it. So the father gives you his blessing. I don't think that's a necessity. For example, if you had an unbelieving father who said, no, son, you're never leaving my household. The blessing of the father is not a necessity in principle for the young man to be regarded as the head of his own household. So leaving father and mother and cleaving to your wife does create a new household, but that verse is not saying that is the only time a young man can leave his household, is when he goes to cleave to his wife. That verse is merely saying that when you cleave to your wife, an independent household is formed. You are separate from your father, from your old household. A new family has been created. That's all that emphasizing. It's not saying that's the only time you can leave mother and father, is when you get married and form a.
Well, excuse my ignorance, and that is then, how then does a son be a head of his household under his father's roof.
When he's living at home?
Yeah.
Well, you see that there would be, the father would relate to him in a different way than he's relating to his other children. There's still house rules. If that person was renting a house from somebody else, you'd still have certain rules with respect to the loan agreement or the lease agreement. Or if he was in a boarding kind of place where, some old lady is renting out rooms, he would still be subject to house rules. But there's a different relationship between that father as far as to saying, well, I'm going to control these details. There's a maturity and there's a recognition. And if that can't be worked out together between them, then the young man would need to have his own place. But there's nothing fundamentally wrong. He is his own head of household, and his authority then is under the church, just as the father's authority, who's over the father, is coming under the church. He's now separated from being under the direct authority of his father.
Well, it's also not an absolute thing, too, right? Just logically, because you can have someone who has the gift of celibacy, they're never going to be married, and this is a logical argument. They're 65 and dad is 80, and I wouldn't imagine anybody would expect it to still be under the
authority of that thing. Well, the father is still expected. The question is, does that require it then?
All right. Anyone else want to add anything? Well, let's spend some time in prayer.